the source of all spiritual pleasure, spiritual satisfaction. So,
February 21st, 2013, at a university in Bloemfontein.
Together in that 16-word song, if you like, is mantra or spiritual sound. But you'll hear more about that as well in the presentation. As you'll probably notice, those little red bits of paper are invitation to our center up in the West Dean. So if you wanted to, you know, find out more, you can always come and see us there. Our times and telephone numbers, website, everything's on there.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama.
thank you for coming today. I think we have some handouts. Okay. So, of course, when most people think about yoga at the present time, they think about it as a series of exercises. And sometimes maybe exercises, bodily exercises with different breathing patterns. That's generally what people think about, yes? Something that people do to get physically fit, or maybe even to feel peaceful and get physically fit. And sometimes one may think of yoga as very difficult postures. You know, sometimes you see pictures of yoga that look like something only Olympic acrobats could do. the meaning of yoga is simply to link, to add. It could just mean plus. One yoga, one equals two. And the idea of yoga is to link our individual consciousness with the total consciousness of truth. And the total consciousness of truth can be understood in many, many ways, but for simplicity, we'll talk about three main ways. It can be understood as all-pervading energy and light and being and consciousness. And the Sanskrit term for that is Brahman. The truth can also be understood as the witness, the friend, the controller, which is all-pervading being and knowledge, sort of the super self. The Sanskrit word for that is Paramatma. Atma means self, Param means super or above. So that would be like the soul of the universe, that the whole truth, the absolute truth, shall we say, truth with a capital T. So it could be Brahman or Paramatma, so the great spirit, formless energy, or the form of a person as the witness and the friend, as the and the super self, one who knows everything that we're thinking and who's in a neutral, detached way overseeing, creating and overseeing the universe. And it could also, the absolute truth or ultimate reality can also be understood on the level. And those first two levels are what we encounter in most of the Western religious traditions, more or less. And then the other is called Bhagavan. Bhagavan means the supreme person. Not just the person who's the witness and the judge and the creator and the maintainer, but the person who has his own activities. So, you know, if you've most ideas of God as a person is just sort of he's on a big throne, wearing a business suit, sort of faceless. I don't know if you've ever seen those little tracks, you know. You go to heaven and you go to hell, right? Mm-hmm. But that's, there's a, beyond that. So there's, Bhagavan is the absolute truth in his own abode, with his own activities, which are all activities of play and fun. Without any, there's no work to be done. There's nothing big to accomplish other than enjoyment of relationship and fun and variety, which is of course what we would like to have. But in this world we have a consciousness of so much to be done. So yoga is a process by which one links one's consciousness with the supreme consciousness. And some yoga practitioners are aiming for a linking with the supreme consciousness as Brahman, which is basically supreme being, with the supreme consciousness as Paramatma, which is supreme being and knowledge, or with the supreme consciousness as Bhagavan, which is supreme being, knowledge, and happiness and bliss and joy. And depending on what level of the Supreme Consciousness one wants to link with, one will adopt different kinds of yoga. Now, it is possible to start with linking with the Brahman and go from there to the Paramatma and go from there to Bhagavan, in which case we talk about something called a yoga ladder. Now, there are different names given to different kinds of yoga in different places, and the names that we're going to use here are not necessarily the only names that there are. But you'll find that although there's a variety of names, they're basically what they're talking about are all the forms that we're going to look at today. So let's look first at the yoga ladder. So the yoga ladder starts, you can just look at this one that says yoga ladder. At the bottom of the yoga ladder, you see something called Ugra Karma. Karma means activity, and Ugra means terrible. It's also called Vikarma. Vikarma basically means bad karma. So this is people who are not really trying to link with the Supreme Consciousness at all. They're materialists who are engaged more or less in doing things that are opposed to truth, which is a very good way of defining what sin is. So sin isn't really like a list, there's this list of rules and somebody decides that these things are called sin. What sin really is doing things that are out of harmony with reality. Now, of course, different societies may end up defining sin differently in different cultural contexts. So you may end up with certain cultures at certain times, you will end up with certain cultures at certain times in history that define sin or piety in ways that have nothing to do with harmony with truth. You know, it's defined how the people in power, it's more like what's in harmony with the people in power rather than what's in harmony with truth. But the actual definition of sin and piety is what's more or less in harmony with truth. Something like, you know, if I try to eat these symbols, you know, I'll break my teeth and I'll get indigestion and I might have to go to the hospital. Because although the human body has to eat some metals every day, we have to eat things like zinc, right, and iron. But my body's not designed to eat metal in this form. So because this is not in harmony with truth, it's not in harmony with reality, it will make me sick. So sin means actions or mentalities that are out of harmony with reality, and therefore they bring what we would say bad karma. The word karma really means action, but they bring bad reactions. Like if I try to eat this, I would get a bad reaction. And that's not because that there's some mean person in the sky who says, let you suffer for eating that. It's just that things are designed to work in a particular way. It's exactly like someone designed this building with walls and doors. And if you decide to try to walk through the wall instead of the door, you'll get hurt. And it's not that the architect was a vicious person who said, let me design these walls to hurt people. So you could define vikarma as people trying to walk through walls instead of doors. And therefore, not only are they not linking their consciousness with the Supreme Consciousness, they're not really even able to enjoy on a material level. So above that is what we call karmakanda. Karmakanda or karma. The word karma generally refers to pious activities or activities in harmony with the creation, activities in harmony with the body, in harmony with the planet, in harmony with universal laws. But those activities performed in harmony with universal laws are not exactly for the sake of linking with the Supreme Consciousness, they're for the sake of enjoying the material world. So you have two classes of people. Broad classes. I mean, obviously you can't fit everybody into two classes. That's ridiculous. But two broad classes. Some people who want to enjoy the material world by walking through walls, and some people who want to enjoy the material world by walking through doors. You know, some people want to enjoy the material world by eating healthy food, and some people want to enjoy the material world by eating junk food. Something like that. You know, some people want to enjoy by getting exercise and climbing mountains, and other people want to enjoy by drinking beer and smoking cigarettes. So one is in harmony with the design of the body and the design of the mind and the design of the planet and etc. And one is out of harmony. But the mentality is still, I want to be the master of the world. The mentality is the same, although it's exhibited. One is exhibiting it more intelligently than another. And the person who's acting, who's doing things in harmony, even for the wrong purpose, has the advantage that they can go from there to a system of yoga very easily. That a person who's trying to enjoy the world in a way that's out of harmony with the world is going to have a harder time linking their consciousness with the Supreme if and when they try to do so. Does that make sense to everybody? Because if I'm going to link with the Supreme Consciousness is the ultimate manifestation of harmony. So if I'm already in a mood of being harmonious, it will be much easier for me to engage in a process of transcendence, even if I'm trying to be harmonious for a materialistic purpose. So the people who are trying to be inharmonious materialists are at a disadvantage when taking to processes of yoga, which require ultimate harmony, not just of action, but of spirit and of heart. You could say that the harmonious materialists, they're harmonious in their action, but not in their heart. In their heart, they're still thinking, I want to be the center, I want to be the top. So the next step on the yoga ladder is called karma yoga. It's also sometimes called kriya yoga. Karma, again, means action. Kriya also means action. So what karma yoga means is you're doing the same things that, shall we say, a pious person or a materialist who wants to live in harmony is doing. Your actions are not radically different, but you're changing your consciousness. So you're saying, okay, I'm going to be a vegetarian not just so I can be healthy, but I'm going to be a vegetarian so I can become purified, so I can attain liberation. Now, in order to be qualified to perform karma yoga, you first have to be performing karma. You have to know what it is. You can't do harmonious things harmoniously unless you're first doing harmonious things. Now, this is a very significant point because most of the people running around on the planet today don't even know how to live harmoniously externally. And if we say, first you've got to do that, and you've got to do that well, before you can start doing karma yoga, well, a lot of people are never going to progress to doing karma yoga because, you know, our lives are even constituted such that really living completely harmoniously with the cosmos is pretty difficult, even if you want to do it. Now, what happens when you do karma yoga is you're working without trying to enjoy the results of your work. Now, it's a subtle point, and it's a little difficult to understand. But when we're working for our own self, when we're working as a materialist doesn't just mean you want to have a big car and you want to have a big house and you have lots of money. There are materialists who want to enjoy the world by living simply. But the point is, I want to be the enjoyer of the world. I want to be the big geez. I don't know what expressions you have for that here. I'm thinking, I spent some time in Hawaii, we call that the big kahuna, but I don't know what you call that here. So the person who's a materialist is thinking, okay, I'm the doer, I'm the controller, which of course, if you think about it for a moment, objectively is ridiculous. Which of us can be the big controller? You can be the big controller? Okay, oh, upstairs. So if a person's thinking, I'm the big doer and I'm the big controller, and they're working for a certain result, they're thinking, okay, I'm doing this work so I can get a degree. I'm getting the degree so I can get a certain job. I'm getting the job so I can have status in society, so I can have money in society, so I can have the nice house by the mountain or by the beach, right? And I can attract the most attractive mate, and I can have intelligent, attractive, and so on and so forth and so on. And that when I die, I'll feel, yes, I did everything I wanted to do and got everything I wanted to get. By the way, nobody ever thinks that way. But in any case, nobody ever dies thinking, I got everything I wanted to get and did everything I wanted to do. But the fruit of mentality is, I sacrifice, I work hard, I sacrifice, I work hard, and I get a fruit. Something like you plant a seed, you know, you plant an apple seed and you get a tree, and you want the apples. So you may not enjoy planting the seed, you don't enjoy necessarily weeding and fertilizing, but you're hoping for the apples. And of course, you might get the apples and you might not. There might have been a frost after it flowered and all the flowers were killed and there's no apples at all. Or the apples may be full of worms, or the birds eat the apples, or some thief climbs into your property and steals the apples. Right? So the karma mentality, the karma kanda mentality, or the vikarma mentality also, is the vikarmi is the person stealing the apples, and the karma kandi is the person growing the apples. So, but both of them want to enjoy the apples. It's sacrifice and hard work and basically difficulty. And then, you know, hard work, hard work, hard work, fruit. And sometimes you get to the fruit and there's no fruit. So it's like basically periods of sacrifice with occasional, maybe, perhaps, moments of enjoyment. After which, immediately, you start working towards another fruit. So that's the vikarma and the karma. Now, as soon as you go into yoga, it's quite different. In yoga, you're no longer working for the fruit. You're working for the moment-by-moment experience of linking with the Supreme Consciousness. We have another hand up for her. So in karma yoga, while you're planting the seed, while you're taking, at every moment, you're saying, I'm offering this for my liberation. I'm offering this for my enlightenment. I'm offering this by moment for my enlightenment. Okay, you with me?
Yes.
All right. Now, what happens by doing that is you attain peace. Because whenever you're working for a fruit, you're going to be in anxiety. Will I get the fruit? Will I not get the fruit? Will I get the fruit? Will I not get the fruit? Will I get the fruit? Will I not get the fruit? Will it taste good when I get it? You know, will somebody else steal it? Will it be good for anything? Am I going to get my degree? Am I not going to? Am I going to get it? 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 When I get it, will I be happy with it? Or will I think, oh, I should have studied something else? Right. Will it be useful for something? Or will people say, sorry, no jobs in your field? Right. So always an anxiety. Okay, I got the job, but maybe they'll fire me. Maybe they'll hire somebody else. I got the beautiful mate, but maybe they'll run off with somebody else. Or maybe they'll die. Or maybe this, or maybe that. Right? Always an anxiety. Will I get it? Will I like it? Because many times we don't get it, isn't it? We work hard for something and we don't get it. We have experience. And many times we work hard for something, we get it, and then we go, oh, why did I get that? And many times we work hard for something, we get it, it's great, and then we lose it. So the fruitive worker is always in anxiety, and one who's dedicating moment by moment achieves peace. Now, when you've achieved peace through karma yoga, then you can go to the next step called gyan yoga. Gyan means knowledge. And on this step of gyan yoga, what you can do is you can start to focus your mind away from materialistic activities. The person in gyan yoga generally is not doing external work in the world like anybody else. So if you looked at a karma yogi and a karma kandi, their external work would look very similar. They're both doing good work, you know, for lack of a better term. They're doing work that's harmonious with reality. Not just good according to some particular cultural or legal definition, but they're actually doing work that's good in a real sense. So externally they look the same. The internal consciousness is different. But when one has become successful in karma yoga, one loses interest in doing much external work in the world. One has attained mental peace. And with that mental peace, one engages in gyan yoga. Gyan yoga is primarily cultivating detachment. And traditionally this was done by studying the sacred literatures called the Vedas, which explain how everything in this world is temporary and illusory. We're something other than the body, we're something other than the mind, we're something other than the world, we're eternal beings, like that. And by studying these things and by meditating on them, which you can only do if your mind is peaceful. If your mind isn't peaceful, you can't sit around and you'll think about them for a couple minutes. I mean, I remember when I was first interested in this sort of thing, well, not when I was first interested, when I first started becoming very involved in this sort of thing when I was in university, and I would talk to my friends about it, and they'd say, oh, that's interesting, now let's go get a pizza. So if your mind's not peaceful, you can't sit all day, every day, and study philosophy. So gyan yoga is basically coming to enlightenment through the study of philosophy. Now, once you've done that, then your degree of peace is even deeper. And then you're able to take up Dhyan Yoga. Dhyan Yoga is also called Raja Yoga. It's also called Astanga Yoga. Dhyana literally means meditation. So in the process of Dhyan Yoga, you're not just thinking about philosophy and studying philosophy and gaining detachment, but now you enter into a deep meditative trance. And the Gyan Yogi traditionally left society completely. So the Gyan Yogi might have still been interacting with society. You could see a Gyan Yogi working as, say, a professor or a theologian or a priest or somebody like that. They weren't doing ordinary running around in the world, but they were still interacting with the world to some extent. And the Karma Yogi and the Gyan Yogi might even have a family, but the Gyan Yogi probably not. The Gyan Yogi is going off in the forest and eating the fruits and herbs that are found in the forest. Now, it's in Gyan Yoga that one is performing the asanas and the pranayama. And the purpose of the asanas and the pranayama, the purpose of the sitting postures and the breathing exercises, is that they mechanically put your mind into a state of trance. Just like every night right before we go to sleep and every morning right when we're waking up, we go naturally into a state of trance. Our brain waves are different, and our brain waves are very much like that of a deep hypnotic or deep yogic trance. But generally, we don't have much control over that. So the person in Gyan Yoga, they are intentionally controlling, putting themselves into a trance where the mind isn't just peaceful. The Karma Yogi achieved peace by which he or she could practice Gyan Yoga, and in Gyan Yoga with a peaceful mind to develop detachment. But the Gyan Yogi doesn't just have peace of mind. The Gyan Yogi puts the mind to sleep completely. And the Gyan Yogi is functioning on a much higher platform than mind. The Gyan Yogi is functioning on the platform of buddhi, or intelligence. And that does not mean what we call IQ or intelligence in the world today. It's a different subtle aspect of the astral body. There's three aspects of the astral body: mind, intelligence, and ego. They come from a different part of subtle energy, and they function differently. The mind is flipping back and forth between accepting and rejecting and jumping all over the place. So the Karma Yogi and Gyan Yogi have made it somewhat still. The Gyan Yogi, it's sleeping. It's something like what we enter into in deep sleep, except in Gyan Yoga, your intelligence is active. So when we go into deep sleep, nothing's active. The mind is sleeping. We're in a state in Gyan Yoga called Pratyahara, where our senses are withdrawn from sense objects. But we're not meditating on anything. It's just kind of blank. Whereas the Gyan Yogi is actually meditating. And they're meditating on the Supreme Consciousness, on generally one of the first two levels, either the level of just being and energy, or the level of being and knowledge. So you can see, and the asanas and the pranayama, the postures and the breathing, they're meant to facilitate that. That the body is designed that if you put it in a certain posture and you breathe in a certain way, it will promote a certain state of consciousness. Exactly like we all learn, you know, practically from day one of birth, that if you lie very still in a prone position, you're likely to fall asleep. You know, you put your body in a certain posture and you do a certain kind of breathing, and you're likely to go into a sleep state, into a dreaming state. So similarly, if you put your body in certain postures and you breathe in a certain way, you're likely to go into a trance state. But you can see, in order to even do that, you have to first have had a very peaceful mind through Gyan, and you had to have had also peace through Karma Yoga. So it's not possible for a person to go directly from being a materialist, whether an inharmonious or harmonious materialist, to Gyan Yoga. You cannot do it. You can skip the Karma Yoga platform. You can go from Karmakanda directly to Gyan Yoga, but you can't go directly to Gyan Yoga. You have to have had first Karma Yoga or Gyan Yoga, usually both, because first your mind's got to be peaceful, and your mind can only be peaceful by working in that way. That's the system of the yoga ladder. And you can see that that system is not very doable for most people in our modern society. First of all, it's very hard for us to have even an external life that's fully in harmony with the universe. That's extremely difficult. You know, even if we really try to be conscientious and we really try to be ecological minded, and, you know, it is so hard. And then if you have to have that as your qualification just to do karma yoga, which is also very difficult, because at that stage there's not, you're not really getting any bliss. The best you're getting is peace, which may be much better than material anxiety, but it's still not bliss. So there's another system of yoga, which is a system that I've been practicing now for 40 years, which is called bhakti. And the difference between the yoga ladder and bhakti is that bhakti is more like a lift rather than a ladder. It takes you right to the source immediately. It takes you right to the root of the problem. So the first nice thing about bhakti is you get right to the root of our disconnection. Get right to the source. Another nice thing of bhakti is you go right to the top level of connection immediately. You're not going to the Brahman level or the Paramatma level. You go right to the Bhagavan level of connection. And the other nice thing about bhakti is you don't have to have any kind of qualification to start it. That anybody can start it from any position. So even if your life is a complete wreck in terms of universal harmony, you can still start bhakti. It doesn't require any kind of material qualification. And what to speak of any kind of qualification of, you know, learning or material intelligence or bodily ability or gender or race or nationality or wealth or any of those sort of things. It certainly doesn't have any of those sort of prerequisites. It's basically available to any living being, but particularly a living being who's in the human form. And bhakti starts generally, for most people, just like in the yoga ladder, usually people start with being externally in harmony with the world, and then they start working on their consciousness. So similarly in bhakti, most people start at the external level and gradually come to a deeper and deeper internal level until everything, the external body, the mind, the intelligence, is all engaged in this yoga. And when that happens, the real self is awakened. The real self is awakened. Now, through the yoga ladder also, the real self is awakened, but it's a much more arduous process. And the basic idea behind bhakti is that the Supreme Consciousness in its most complete form is a playful person. A person engaged in play, in eternal play, and eternal sport, in simply reciprocations of love. Not just a pervading light of being, and not just a person of judgment and witness and facilitation, but a playful, youthful, eternally playful being who is unlimited, and unlimited in form, unlimited in scope, and yet has a playful form, who is full of light, but who is the darkest black. And this person is called Krishna, the all-attractive. And bhakti yoga is linking our consciousness with that supreme, not by just giving up fruits for our own liberation and enlightenment, not by detachment through philosophical study, not by mechanical trance, but by love. And by love, one naturally goes into a trance. Right? When you're in love with somebody, don't you kind of go into a kind of trance? And the world runs away and you don't even see it anymore. Right? You're walking around in the world just, woo, yeah. Yeah. So that's the kind of samadhi that you enter into through bhakti. It's very natural and very easy because we all know how to do that. You know, I may not know how to do detached pious activities and sit around studying philosophy all day or go off in a mountain cave and do a bunch of postures and sitting exercises, but I know how to fall in love. I know how to be overwhelmed with attachment, and in that overwhelming attachment have everything else be insignificant. So bhakti is getting that overwhelming attachment for the most attractive person, who is the ultimate manifestation of Supreme Consciousness. So first in bhakti, one does activities as if one was in love. One, in one sense, practices love, which sounds ridiculous. How can you practice love? But that's the beginning of bhakti. And gradually, one should engage in changing one's mentality. So the original love of Krishna, which is inherent in every single living being, it's our natural position to be in full loving union. Not that we merge, but the loving union as you'd have between a husband and wife, or parent and child, or friend and friend. That's our natural position. So the science of bhakti is exactly like that. And it's fairly simple. I mean, it does require some lifestyle prerequisites in order to act quickly. So one cannot be living a lifestyle. One can go immediately from an inharmonious lifestyle, but one has to adopt at least some elements of a harmonious lifestyle. So, for example, we don't eat meat, fish, or eggs. That the human body is not actually designed very well to digest these things. Plus, that kind of diet involves a lot of violence and cruelty to other living beings. So we don't take intoxicants. We want to have the natural intoxicant of love and linking with the Supreme Consciousness. At intoxicants, toxic means poison, and basically all intoxicants are giving yourself just enough poison to get a little out of it, but not enough to kill you. That's kind of the idea of intoxicants.
Okay, just one cue.
Yes.
Bhakti yoga, it means that you have to be vegan instead of vegetarian.
No, you can be vegetarian. We eat milk.
Oh, okay.
Ideally, we have a number of farms where we have our own cows that are protected and not killed and not exploited. We don't eat eggs. We don't eat fish or eggs. And then also no illicit sex. So illicit sex is basically, this may be the hardest one for some of you, it's basically an exploitive situation. You know, it's not really in harmony with the way the body is designed. It's, you know, having children is also called procreation, which is pro-creation. So illicit sex is one has to do something to make the body function in a way that it wasn't meant to design to be, and it's basically exploitive. I'm going to take something from you, and you're going to take something from me, and you know it's not really illicit relationships are not really relationships of real love and giving. And then no gambling, because gambling is also a very cheating. You know, you get together with your friends, and everybody puts in 100 rand, and you're hoping to take all of your friends' money without giving them anything in return. You're not giving them any goods or services in return. All you're giving them is the promise they might be able to take your money. So in order for bhakti yoga to advance quickly, bhakti yoga can advance in anybody in any condition, but in order for one to advance quickly, it's very, very helpful to have to refrain from those four ways of acting those are all very exploitive ways of acting. And the core of our practice is just simply saying the names that refer to Bhagavan, the names that refer to the Supreme Absolute Consciousness as the playful, dark, youthful God of love. So his chief name, his many, many names, unlimited name, his chief name is Krishna, another one of his names is Rama, and his chief beloved is called Hare. And these names are not like ordinary material sound. That the sound and the person, the experience are the same. And so by meditating on these sounds, then one gets realization, actually, of Bhagavan. And then there's a whole more detailed science for which one needs to have a guide or a guru to help one advance in that science. All right, so we have about 5 minutes for questions, if anybody has any. Yes.
Okay, I'm reading this book. It's about the day you were born. So my question is, when you were born, or like your star sign, or astrology, whatever, does it affect, can it affect maybe the form of meditation and how you can do it and how can
you... Oh, that's a very good question. A horoscope, astrology, is more like a clock. So a clock doesn't force the sun to be in the sky at a particular place. It simply tells you where the sun is. So horoscope and also your palms are a way, they're a language, if you can read the language, that tells you something about what you've done in previous lives and what you're coming into this life with, what some of your destiny is. And it will certainly tell you what your inclinations are.
And your strengths and your spiritual strength and abilities. And
definitely. But anybody can perform bhakti.
Okay.
So definitely not anybody can perform karma yoga or gyan yoga, which is speak of gyan yoga. But anybody can perform bhakti yoga. Doesn't matter. Some people are, though, naturally going to be more inclined to it than others. Some people have no interest in enlightenment at all. That doesn't mean they couldn't. It doesn't mean there's something inherently about them that they couldn't. But some people, due to their own choices in previous lives and in this life, simply are not interested in enlightenment. They don't believe in it, or all their... Some people are, I mean, we hate to say, are practically like animals. All they're concerned about is when am I going to get food and sex and shelter and get rid of my enemies. Mm-hmm. You know, and they don't think beyond that. Even though they may apparently be engaged in very human activities, if you're all you're interested in is eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, you know, that's really not any different from the dogs and the giraffes. So there are people like that, and that... Or people that their knowledge is just their work. You know, I go to work, I do my job, I make some money, I come home, I sit in front of the football game, I drink some beer, have some sex, and go to sleep.
Routine.
You know, and it's very hard to interest people like that in enlightenment.
Enlightenment? What for?
And then there are people who are really trying to be, you know, a big person in the world. I want to make a lot of money, and I want to have a lot of status, and I want to have the biggest house and the biggest car, and, you know, the fanciest this, the fanciest that, and I want to be known as a good person, and I want to have my name in the letters in the history book, you know, and I want to have a statue of me in the middle of the town, and so forth and so on, and I want everybody to say, what a good person, what a righteous person, this person really worked for the community and for the world. So those people generally aren't that interested in enlightenment either, although they can be. And then there are the people who are like, you know, I want peace. I want peace, and I want beauty. And they're thinking, I want enlightenment. I want salvation. So for those people, it's easiest. But anybody can take up bhakti, you know. Even the guy with the beer in front of the football game can take up bhakti. It's possible. You know, we do come in with some proclivities, for sure. But that doesn't, as far as bhakti, that doesn't restrict you. Yes?
Having a Christian upbringing, we are taught that you have to go to Christ, to Jesus, and tell your sins if you have done something wrong, and then he will forgive it.
Okay.
Is that principle the same with bhakti?
It's very similar. I mean, the idea of going, of going through Jesus is the concept that you need some guide. That you can't just make up your own system of enlightenment. Like he says, no one comes to the Father but through me. Mm. So when people tell me that verse, I say, well, do you have a minister? Why are you listening to your minister? So on the first point of going to Jesus, I don't know of anybody who just goes to Jesus directly. Even if you're reading the Gospels, they weren't written by Jesus. They were written by Luke and, right? Matthew. So you're still going to Jesus and... You're going to Jesus and Matthew, Jesus and Luke, Jesus and John, Jesus and John and your minister.
Yeah. It's like saying, right? You're not worth enough of way. Now you can't approach... You can't be whole on your own. Like, you need...
Well, you actually do need... You actually do need a guide. Mm. You do need... Everyone does need a spiritual guide. So I'm saying that's a valid point. But I think sometimes Christians don't understand... That not only do they have Jesus as their guide, they also have people walking around the planet today and other people who were living at the time of Jesus as their guides. Mm. So when people come to me and say, well, you know, you're not going to attain perfection because you're going to someone other than Jesus, and my answer to them is, well, you're also going to people other than Jesus. You're not going to only Jesus. Mm. So that's the first point. Yes, you have to have a guide. Do you have to go to someone and admit you've done something wrong? The answer is yes. And that's not just a question of going and saying, you know, I took an extra donut today at work even though I knew that somebody else might not get one. It's really what one needs to confess, and one needs to confess ultimately to God, is, well, I haven't been acting in harmony with truth. I haven't been acting in love. The other things are details, that you took the extra donut or that you yelled at your kid, or those are the symptoms. Now, some people may have worse symptoms than others. You know, some people may be murderers and other people are just donut thieves. But those are symptoms. The real problem is that I'm trying to be the Lord of the world, and I'm trying to enjoy the world, and I'm acting out of sync with the Supreme Consciousness. I'm not acting in a loving, reciprocal, beautiful dance with reality. I'm singing my own out-of-tune song. And yes, that has to be admitted. Definitely that has to be admitted, without question. And the admission of such and the actual seeing of such, the realization of such, is a lot of what we call humility. Humility really is just saying the truth. The truth is, I'm a spiritual being. I have most of the qualities of God. I'm an eternal being, full of beauty and power and love and grace and all the wonderful qualities that anybody could possibly have. And I have chosen at some point to act not as I am, to act as somebody who was full of greed and envy and etc., fear. And how what a foolish thing that I have done. And let me now go back to being who I really am. So that admission should be both very sweet, because it's involved with seeing who you are, and full of some bitterness of apology. But it's not just an official ritual that you go and say, "Ah, oh, yeah, I did this," and you just talk to somebody and come back next week. I mean, that's okay, but it's not. You're not getting to the essence. So is that all right? I think we need to end now. We have a little snack for you, and thank you very much for coming. We also have a center. If you want to tell them more about our center.
Yeah, the center's up in West Dean. We have gatherings there on a Wednesday evening and on a Sunday. So